bank was slick, but Anya managed to navigate it. Her cameraman was not as sure-footed and had almost lost his balance. The city above was clean, but the riverbank was another matter. Plastic foam cups, crushed cigarette packs, and other assorted garbage pooled in low spots. Brayman checked over his camera and wiped at the water again, a futile gesture as it was raining harder.
Let's wrap this up.
I second and third that. Doug's bad idea is getting worse and worse.
Miss Creed, my brother waits there.
Jacques slogged forward, pointing to a recess under the bridge. Anya and Raymond followed behind him.
Now I have a bad feeling about this. Gaston?
A figure emerged from the shadows. He had a build similar to Jacques, but Anya couldn't make out any details other than that he looked bedraggled and rumpled.
I am Gaston.
Anya paused, but Raymond, camera to his face, stepped forward over broken glass and gravel. His backside looked like a mud slick.
She said she would pay us. Miss Creed has money.
So you're a cynocephalus?
Raymond paused and stood directly in front of the man, blocking Anya's view of him.
One of the dog men of France? You look pretty human to me. In fact, hey, what are you...
It happened fast. The two grabbed Raymond and spun him around, the taller putting a knife to his throat, the other producing a blade and holding it to his stomach. Raymond dropped the camera, his arms flailing. He stopped moving when the one named Gaston drew blood.
Stay still, if you want to leave.
Anya had been reaching for the sword with her mind, had felt the sensation of the pommel forming against her palm, but didn't take it. The blade hung in the otherwhere, waiting.
I told Jacques the money's at the hotel. I've only got a few euros with me. You can have them, but...
We don't want your money, Anya Creed. We want your sword.
Gaston nudged Raymond farther out from under the bridge. Anya recognized Gaston. He was one of the gang she'd fought in Paris outside the train station. He was one of the Romanys who'd fled before the police arrived.
You.
The sword. If you hand over the sword, Anya Creed, we'll let your friend live.
Anya! Give him my money.
The sword, American archaeologist. It was not in your hotel room. At either hotel. Where is it? Where is the old sword?
I don't have a sword. Do you see a sword?
The sword! Hand it over! Hurry!
I've got no sword here. No gun, no knife. You can see I have no weapon. But I have money. Euros. We were going to pay for an interview. We've got money for that. We can go back to the hotel, all of us, Gaston, and...
A ruse to get you here. Dog men.
Look, whoever you are...
We don't want your money, American.
The tall one drew the knife down Raymond's throat. The pressure was enough to produce a line of blood, but not enough to cause the photographer serious harm.
Anya, give them whatever they want!
I do not think you worry about your friend, American archaeologist. I do not think you consider us serious. I can promise you, we are serious! We will kill if we have to!
His companion jabbed Raymond in the stomach, again enough to draw blood.
She should take us serious, eh, Dimitru?
The tall one scowled. So she had one piece of information, a name, Dimitru, definitely Romani.
Dimitru, you say you want a sword. I could...
No, not a sword, your sword. The one you flashed in Paris that night so late, before the police came and took my brothers.
I'll have to get it for you. I'm not carrying a sword.
Anya extended her arms to her sides and opened her hands as wide as her fingers would stretch. She turned slowly, glad for the opportunity to look behind her. She saw the ship, a barge, not yet close enough. It didn't look as if anyone was on deck. She hadn't heard anyone come up behind her. Other than the threats of the Romanys, she'd heard only the sounds of traffic across the bridge and past the embankment. Finished with her circle, she faced the Romany again. They'd pulled Raymond a little deeper into the shadows under the bridge.
It won't take me long.
You think me simple? You have the sword, Anya Creed. You have it with you. Maybe it is invisible, maybe it is a ghost thing, but I know you have it.
We are done talking to her. Right, Dimitru? A boat is coming. Someone might see us.
They see nothing, this rain.
Anya, what are they talking about? We can give them money, can't we? My camera, I dropped it there. They can have that. Anya, tell them they can have it.
We do not want your money. We want the woman's sword. I am done with this.
Stop. Leave him alone. Let Raymond out of here. Let him leave and you can have the sword.
Raymond is our insurance, Anya Creed. Is the sword worth more than his life?
Of course not. Let him go.
The ghostly sword... For the photographer, then. Now! Make it appear! Now! Like before!
She felt the pommel touch her palm, and she wrapped her fingers around it.
What? the hell?
This what you want?
Drop it and back away.
Anya set the sword gently at her feet in the scrubby weeds and the remains of someone's fast food dinner that had been tossed off the bridge. From the Romani's vantage point, the weeds would block the sword from view. Anya stepped back and sent it into the otherwhere. Dimitru's expression didn't change.
Let him go. Raymond is not a part of this. There's the sword. We had a bargain.
Dimitru hurled Raymond behind him. And the shorter Romani kicked the photographer in the back of the legs, dropping him to the gravel. At the same time, Dimitru shot toward Anya, knife slashing to keep her at bay.
Get back! Get back and no one has to be hurt!
Dimitru came to the spot where she'd dropped the sword.
A trick! Where is it? Petra! Kill the man! Kill him!
Instantly, the sword was in Anya's hands again. She brought it around, but Dimitru somehow turned into it, rushed her in a crouch, and caught himself across the throat. He managed to stab her in the thigh, but his knife didn't sink deep. The knife wound hurt, but worse was the bitter sting of an avoidable death.
Dwell on that later.
Anya kept hold of the sword with her left hand. With her right, Anya tugged out the knife and dropped it next to the body. She stepped around Dimitru and headed toward the other man, Petra. He'd been bending over Raymond, one hand grasping the back of his head, the other ready to slice his throat. But at the sight of Anya advancing on him, he bolted, angling up the steep, slick embankment. The photographer stayed down, wrapping his arms over his head. Anya glanced at him as she charged after the Romani, dismissing the sword and pumping her fists to speed her feet. Raymond didn't appear to be badly hurt, and she desperately needed to find out why they wanted her sword, how they knew about it. She followed the youth up the bank, catching sight of him, cresting the top and sprinting into traffic. Anya dodged the cars, taking only a little more care than her quarry had, which cost her precious seconds. The storm had increased in intensity. Her quarry was easy to make out from the other pedestrians braving the weather. None of them were running and pushing people out of their way, and nearly all of them had umbrellas or hats. She was about a block and a half behind him, gaining a little and tromping through a puddle. Anya lost sight of Petra when he rounded a corner. When she skidded around it after him, the Palais du Pape loomed into view, the place where she and Raymond had first met Jacques.
There.
Anya spotted his dash through the entrance. It was a beautiful building, wholly in its original intent, and she disliked the notion of the Romani punk hurtling through it.
Petra! Stop! Petra! I only want to talk!
Anya raced through the entrance. She didn't see her quarry, but there were signs to mark his passing. Another visitor picking himself up, a man retrieving papers and other objects that had been scattered, not to mention the trail of wet footprints. There were more people around now than when Anya and Raymond had been here minutes before. Perhaps a tour bus had dropped them off, or they had come in to escape the storm. The wet trail led into one of the wings. She spotted her quarry just ahead, then the Romani gypsy was out a side door. Anya followed. The rain pounded her once more. The guy was back on the sidewalk, never pausing to look behind him, obviously knowing she was still on his tail. She skidded around a bench and vaulted a large cement pot filled with flowers, landing like a cat before cutting across the street. And then he disappeared behind a bus.
No, you don't.
Anya wasn't about to let him elude her, not now. The bus pulled away from the curb just as she reached it. But a quick scan through the windows didn't show any panic or jostling. The passengers looked calm.
So where? Where did you go, Petra?
Anya studied the entrances to the old buildings, the shops with awnings sagging low from the rain, the people huddled beneath them. Nothing. He hadn't come this way. Wait! There was a gap between two buildings near where the bus had stopped, not wide enough to be an alley. Without thought, Anya plunged down it, the stone wall grazing her shoulder as she went. She hurried past a boarded-up recess. And Petra jumped out at her, shoving her against the opposite wall. He had a knife in his hand, but not enough space to use it effectively. Anya grabbed his wrist and pressed it against the stone, squeezing until he dropped the blade and wedging herself against him. He struggled, but she held him hard.
Don't you move. You know what I'm capable of. You're gonna talk to me now, understand?
Yes.
The sword. Why do you want my sword?
Paid to get it.
Who paid you?
Don't know.
Who?
A collector.
Anya dug her fingers into his arms with enough force to make him wince.
Let's try this again. Petra, right? Who paid you to steal my sword?
Dimitru knew a man. Did work for him in Paris. He paid Dimitru, and Dimitru asked me to help. in Paris and here. This collector, Dimitru, said he was rich.
Ugh. You didn't know this man he did work for?
I told you no, never saw him. But Dimitru said he collects swords.
And how did he know about mine?
Old swords. That's all I know. Special swords. Dimitru was to get yours and then another. Swords of history.
A sudden commotion back on the street caught Anya's attention. Through the haze of rain, she saw flashing blue lights.
Through there! They went through there!
Anya squeezed by Petra, putting distance between herself and the police. Historical swords. She suddenly recalled something Rue had told her days ago.
Be careful, Anya, that an historical monster does not come chasing you.
Dr. Lawton stood at the podium of the lecture hall. The room could hold 300, but he filled it only during his special evening lectures, and he hadn't offered any this semester. Today, he had 100 students. Impressive, given what many of his colleagues considered a dry subject with no practical application for the real world. Fools. He was practicing the applications beneath all their upturned noses. He'd rigged a laptop to a projector, and an image of a man in armor shone larger than life against the wall.
What do you see?
A knight? A Templar?
A suit of armor from a museum. It doesn't look like there's anybody inside it.
Dr. Lawton surveyed the room in silence. In the back row, a few students were texting. Their loss.
What do you see? Can you look past the armor? The metal? Can you look past the centuries? I see blood. I see a lot of blood. I can see the blood of 1,000 warriors who dressed like this and who gave their last breath in defense of their beliefs. I see 1,000 warriors striding to their deaths so the meek and innocent could live without fear. I see valor and love and sacred honor. I see sacrifice and respect, unyielding courage and unwavering faith. This is the armor of a paladin. If a man dressed like this came into a village, peasants and gentry would drop to their knees in respect. Today's soldier gets a pat on the back for his service in Afghanistan, a thank you for his tours in Iraq and Iran, perhaps a slight edge over some chap competing for the same dead-end job. But today's soldier is not held in the same regard as these men. These paladins were put on a pedestal by society, elevated because they were better than the men around them. They embody patience and dignity, grace, in the face of impossible odds.
Lawton touched a key on the laptop to start the slideshow. More suits of armor, woodcut images from history texts, photographs from reenactments.
The paladin. Miss Jensen, do you know his origin?
You're referring to the Knights Templar? The Knights Templar are considered the very first order. God and duty, right?
Dr. Lawton touched another key and a stock image of a Templar knight appeared.
No one coerced a man to join the Templars. Their devotion, righteousness, and ideals came from within. They had no expectation of reward, though they gained considerable wealth for their order. But they were not the first paladins. That honor is due men 500 years earlier.
But the textbook...
You're not reading from my textbook.
Then who were the first paladins? If it wasn't the Templars, then who?
Surely you're familiar with Charlemagne.
There were nods all around. A few tapped on their iPads and netbooks. Ms. Jensen leaned forward in her seat.
I mention him today only because we are covering paladins, and he birthed them. The paladin traces his roots back beyond the establishment of knightly orders.
Didn't the knights create paladins?
In the 8th century, the 12 paladins of Charlemagne came into being. They were 12 powerful soldiers put in charge of his armies. Those 12 protected him and pledged their lives to him.
Voila!
He was Charlemagne's first paladin, yes. If you are curious, Mr. Tarrington, the Song of Roland is in the public domain. A poem of epic adventure and unmatched heroism. I recommend reading it, though it is by no means required for this course. Roland was the first, but there were others. Can you name them?
Ogier the Dane.
I commend you, Miss Appleton. Yes, Ogier the Dane was one as well. They carried special swords. Durandal for Roland, Sauvagine and Courtin for Ogier.
They named their swords. Like a pet dog or something.
The 3 swords were forged by Munificent, each taking 3 years to make, so fine and divine the blades were. And soon all 3 of Munificent's prized swords will be mine.
Mine.
Looking at the Wallace Monument, it looked as if the earth were flipping a defiant finger at heaven. The stone tower stretched upward, with the top made to resemble a king's crown. Arshar had done his research. The monument was built in 1869, very near the spot of William Wallace's victory at Stirling Bridge. It wasn't a particularly pretty setting, but the stone structure loomed over the Scottish countryside. Arshar nosed the rental Fiat into one of the few empty spots in the lot, turned off the ignition, and pocketed the keys.
Are we ready?
Yep. Let's do this.
The backseat passenger gave his neck a roll after getting out. The man felt cramped from sitting in the compact car. Ulrich was a tad over 6 feet tall and very lean. The German's skin looked as if it had been stretched too tight over his frame, his wrists so bony they looked painful. Gaunt was the word Arshar ascribed to the man, pale, unhealthy. But Ulrich, in his late 50s, was fit enough for this particular task, and actually was in deceptively good shape. If Ulrich's accent was more American than German, it was because he'd spent nearly 20 years in the United States, managing an art gallery in Atlanta, Georgia, and lecturing at the university there about ancient art and artifacts. A contemporary of Dr. Lawton's, who'd met the professor when they were working on their advanced degrees, he'd been a part of this group since his return to Europe in January. Arshar liked him. He was a good conversationalist and his intellectual equal. Arshar watched him walk to the trunk. Arshar thumbed a button on the keychain and the trunk popped open.
Well, we don't need the supplies until tonight.
I want to check on them, and I want my camera.
It was Saturday, the weather was good, and tourists waited on the curving walkway to the monument. It was easier to go unnoticed in the middle of a crowd, which was why he'd picked this day. Arshar led the way, pausing near a pair of red-haired women, probably related, who were reading a plaque. He waited until they were finished before stepping up. Sarah and Ulrich joined him. The German aimed his digital camera at the plaque, but no telltale green light came on. Ulrich was only pretending to take pictures. Arshar hoped no one else noticed. At the gate, the German paid cash for their admission. The girl behind the counter looked up at him.
First visit to the Wallace Memorial?
Ulrich nodded. They fell in line behind the red-haired women. The whole purpose of their visit was on the first level. Arshar went there straight away, Sarah and Ulrich a few paces behind. The Wallace sword was displayed point down in a thick plexiglass case that was roped off. Arshar leaned against the wall, admiring the ancient claymore. The cool stone was rough against his fingertips. Arshar found the smell of the stone preferable to the perfume Sarah had used too liberally this morning. A guide entered and gestured to the sword.
The Wallace sword was kept in Dunbarton Castle for many years before being removed to this monument. Wallace wielded it in the Battle of Stirling Bridge in 1297, and then a year later in the Battle of Falkirk.
Was this the only sword he used?
The only one of note. What do you see when you look at it?
I see blood. Blood and death, and Wallace responsible for it all. I see courage and sacrifice. I see men slogging across a battlefield not knowing if the day will be their last.
Yes. According to English records, the governor of Dumbarton Castle was given the sword in 1305. More accounts of the sword are found 200 years later. Then, King James of Scotland was said to have paid 2 dozen shillings to an armourer to give the sword a new scabbard, belt and pommel, as the original scabbard and hilt were supposedly covered with the skin of the English commander Cressingham. There are no more records of the sword until the 1800s, when it was sent for repairs to the Tower of London. Toward the end of that century, it made its way here to the Wallace Monument. Now, if you will follow me, I'll take you through the rest of the monument.
Arshar, Sarah, and Ulrich fell into the middle of the group, which started wending its way up a circular staircase. In the Hall of Heroes, there were busts of middle-aged and old men, noble and aristocratic. Arshar's interest in history hadn't included Scotland, but he was nonetheless familiar with Robert the Bruce, Robbie Burns, and of course William Wallace. Sarah was intently studying the sculpted faces, brow knitted. Arshar knew better. She wasn't interested in the displays, but was doing a good job of looking as if she was.
Though Wallace is a true national hero, there were men in his company of equally strong character.
The guide pointed out busts of several who'd lived during that time.
The men following Wallace beat back the armies of the Earl of Surrey and Hugh de Cressingham, treasurer to King Edward.
The guy whose skin was on the scabbard.
Scottish forces were considered disorganized before Wallace whipped them into shape. The English hadn't been prepared. Wallace directed his spearmen to advance on Stirling Bridge from the high ground. The English cavalry became cut off from the rest of their soldiers and were quickly slain. And Hugh de Cressingham, they flayed him. And historians claim that Wallace indeed took a broad piece of Cressingham's hide and used it as a baldric for his claymore. It wasn't an unheard of practice.
Ghastly!
Wallace showed England that infantry could defeat cavalry, though Scottish casualties weren't recorded. The English claimed to lose 100 cavalry and 5,000 infantrymen. Unfortunately, Wallace didn't get to keep his title of Guardian of Scotland for long. During the summer of 1298, King Edward brought his army north from Flanders. On the field of Falkirk, Wallace was defeated. He eluded capture, however, for a few years.
I watched Braveheart, saw it twice. How close was it to...
Not close, but it was far from a terrible movie.
They gutted Mel Gibson. They made you think they were cutting him open and pulling his innards out.
His character! They gutted his character!
Ah, there are no wee babes here today. Wallace was captured in August 1305, taken to London and then tried for treason. Finding him guilty, they put a garland of oak on his head, pronouncing him King of Outlaws. History recorded his response. I could not be a traitor to Edward, for I was never his subject. Wallace called the absent John Baliol his king.
And the real Wallace was better looking than Mel Gibson.
Wallace's death was quite prolonged. They stripped him and dragged him through London behind a horse. Then he was hanged, strangled, but not yet killed, taken down, castrated, gutted, and his intestines burned while he still breathed. At last quartered, his head was cut off and piked on London Bridge. Then they beheaded Wallace's brothers and put their heads on display too.
Arshar stepped inside the small gift shop. On the lowest level, the crowd began to break up. He selected a keychain with a replica of the Wallace sword and moved to the counter. One of the red-haired women was there with a stack of postcards. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Sarah hold up a rose-colored T-shirt with a picture of the Wallace statue on it.
What you think?
The red-haired woman left, and the pert cashier reached for Arshar's keychain.
Can I help you?
This and a pack of gum. Any flavor.
Any?
Which one do you like?
The cinnamon. It has a bit of a bite to it. Tickles my tongue.
A pack of cinnamon, then. No, make it two.
She grinned and rang up his sale.
Thank you.
He moved away, making room for the elderly man who was buying a postcard. Ulrich was studying the doorframe of the gift shop, eyes drifting up to the security camera. The German had been taking note of all the cameras in the tower and how they were wired. Of course, the devices would be operated from some tucked-away office. Arshar had noted a camera near the display of the Wallace sword, one more in the stairwell, and then one near the top, where the most elaborate statues were arrayed. If there were more, he trusted Ulrich had noticed them. But Arshar suspected there wasn't a lot of security here, the statues being too big to easily haul away. The gift shop was likely a target because of the cash register and some of the pricier souvenirs. And the sword, of course. He considered that the Wallace Monument's greatest treasure. Arshar left the gift shop and headed outside, glad when Sarah and Ulrich followed a few minutes later. He didn't want to linger at the monument too long. He certainly didn't want to do anything to stand out. Arshar chastised himself for the cinnamon gum. The clerk would remember him for that. But that wouldn't link him to the upcoming theft. They spent the rest of the day in town, playing tourists up from Paris and eating a lengthy dinner that the German paid for. The three returned to the Wallace Monument shortly before midnight, seeing only one other car, no doubt belonging to the security guard. One car, probably just one man. Arshar suspected the watch would be doubled after tonight.
Shall we?
He waited until Sarah and Ulrich retrieved backpacks from the trunk. They all walked around to the far side of the monument, to the door used by staff. Sarah set to work on the lock, while Ulrich clipped the wires on the outside security camera and alarm. The three slipped inside. Arshar let his eyes adjust to the dim lights of the corridor. He motioned to a door marked office, and Ulrich went inside. Sarah stayed in the hall, head cocked, listening. Then Arshar heard it. Footsteps going up from the sound of it. Maybe the security man was on a regular patrol. It was a good distance to the top, so that would buy the German time. Ulrich knew security systems even better than Arshar. At the art gallery in Atlanta, he'd constantly updated the monitors and added upgrades to the video feeds. He'd also learned how to disable them. Everything Arshar knew had come from questionable sites on the internet. Sarah's burgeoning skills were mostly internet-acquired, too. Next, they went to the sword room, and Ulrich disabled an independent security sensor affixed to the back of the Wallace sword display. While Arshar and Sarah stood watch, listening for the guard, the German produced a thin cutter he ran down a seam of the plexiglass. Within minutes, he'd opened the case. The metal blade was more than 4 feet long, nearly 2.5 inches wide at the thickest part, and tapering to 3/4 of an inch before the tip. After holding it for a few moments, Arshar decided it felt heavier than the 6 pounds the display plaque claimed. He passed it to Sarah, who held it in front of her with both hands. Blade and pommel together made it taller than she was, and she lowered it quickly.
Only 6 pounds? I don't think so.
Shh! Arshar took it from her and held it out.
It's where the weight is distributed that makes it difficult to hold for any amount of time. I'd say this was quite lethal on the battlefield.
Sarah retrieved a length of folded canvas from her pack and laid it out on the floor. Arshar set the sword on it and wrapped it up.
I've made an error. This won't fit in the trunk of the Fiat.
I'll be even more cramped in the back seat then.
No, I think it's Sarah's turn to be cramped. Time to leave.
They were at the back door when they heard footfalls coming back down, and they were in their car and pulling away when the security guard saw the opened, empty case in the Wallace sword room. The drizzle painted everything gray. It suited Anya's mood. Despite the weather, tourists were out, making the walk up the long flight of steps. There was an elevator, but a sign indicated that the power was out. At least the rain was gentle, not like the storm that had drenched Avignon and her and Raymond 2 days ago. She'd said goodbye to Raymond last night. It was more than 24 hours after the flight he'd wanted to take back to New York, but he'd been treated at the hospital and then quizzed at length through a pair of interpreters at the police station about the death of the Romany under the bridge. They made it clear that Raymond wasn't a suspect, but he was apparently the sole witness, even though someone on the barge had reported seeing 2 people running up the bank. Raymond hadn't said too much about the incident. He had mentioned her, of course, and that they'd been lured to the river with the promise of an interview for a TV show they were working on. Then the Romanese had tried to mug them, figuring them to be rich Americans, Anya especially because she was a television personality. Raymond said everything went fuzzy after that because of the beating he'd sustained. Anya had arrived later at the police station and backed up his story. She admitted to leaving the scene, but only to chase the other Romany, whom, she said, she lost sight of downtown. A few shopkeepers corroborated her report. There was no mention of a sword. The police were left mystified about who actually killed the Romany, though the officer in charge speculated that perhaps the partner who fled was responsible, not wanting to share the American's money. Both Raymond and Anya swore the 2 Romanys had knives and bad tempers, which was the truth. Perhaps if the dead man hadn't been Romany, if he hadn't had a switchblade, the officials would have looked closer into the case. But the police weren't heartbroken over this guy's death, and so Anya and Raymond had been cut loose. Raymond vowed never to come back to France. Anya stopped at one of the stations of the cross, standing behind a middle-aged woman. She offered a silent prayer for Raymond and his family, hoping that everything would turn out well for his daughter and the baby.
Raymond, a grandfather? A rather young grandfather. When I return to New York, I'll have to look him up. Dear God, let him continue to keep his mouth shut about the sword.
216. Anya wondered if there was some significance to the number of steps. They were very worn in places, some in desperate need of repair and a potential hazard to the people using them. But she hoped the town officials wouldn't touch them. Let them be. Let the years and the constant tread of feet continue to wear them away. At the top, Anya stood quietly and took in the ancient buildings. There were no historical monsters here to document for her producer, but the archaeologist in her would love to do an in-depth special about the oldest of the cloisters and the monks who continued to live here. Too bad there was no tie-in for her program. It smelled fresh, in part because the drizzle washed everything clean, brightening the aged stone. The air was absolutely clear this high up, with no trace of exhaust or other pollutants. Just a hint of a campfire and something roasting. Wildflowers grew in patches of dirt between the slabs of rock. Anya's producer hadn't been happy about her decision to take a week's vacation rather than return with Raymond. Doug had argued with her, but then backed off. He always backed off. A week, she'd told him. She would give herself that long to delve into this stolen sword mystery. She passed the final station of the cross and stepped out onto a path of wet clay. Following it, Anya came to an arch too low for a car to pass under, though she saw depressions from repeated traffic by carts and bicycles. A small group of tourists were huddled under it. One of them held up against the drizzle a windbreaker that read, Rocamadour Rocks. It displayed a picture of one of the abbeys poised on the edge of the cliff, as if about to dive into the sea. Anya spotted a tall monk standing under an overhang a dozen yards away. He had his cowl pushed back, and she recognized his face from a picture she'd seen on the internet. Brother Maynard. Thrusting her hands in her pockets, she headed his way. Brother Maynard turned to Anya with his kind, sad eyes.
Miss Anya Creed, the one who inquired about our stolen sword? I have watched some of your programs. Ancient Egyptians in Australia, antique wood coffins in caves in Thailand, all very interesting.
Yes, that's me. Gosh, but the Australian segment was quite some time ago.
I rarely see anything first run. Please, come inside and dry off.
She followed him through a tunnel that opened into a room filled with polished walnut benches. Electric lights, shaped like candles, hung from the center on iron chandeliers, leaving everything appropriately dim. The place was a little deceptive. From the outside, the building didn't look so deep. Some of it must have been carved into the mountain itself.
So it was stolen from this room.
Anya looked around, trying to see where it might have been displayed. Brother Maynard gestured toward the archway they'd come through. Anya studied the archway, noticing the hooks the sword had hung from.
It was hanging there. We removed the cords, but Brother Villand intends to replace the sword with a replica.
I thought it was a copy that hung there.
Ah, yes. The mayor was on record saying that the sword we displayed was not really Roland's, that it was a replica. I think he honestly believes that, but it was genuine. Unless it can be recovered, the one that will replace it will be whole.
Whole? The sword you had was broken?
Legend has it that Roland was on the cliff, helping to hold off an army so that Charlemagne and his men could retreat. He'd intended to destroy the sword so it wouldn't fall into enemy hands, but the blade proved indestructible. He hid it beneath his body, some say. Others say he threw it off the cliff.
And you support the cliff version?
High in the stone, there's a gash where part of the sword remained for centuries.
Part?
Roland inadvertently broke his indestructible sword when he threw it off the cliff. The tip lodged in the rock, and the blade snapped. The sword that hung from our ceiling over there had a section missing.
Don't you have security?
Of course, but apparently it wasn't adequate, and Brother Villand discovered that the system had been dismantled. It wasn't an expensive system, and it was old. We had little fear of thieves. What is there here that someone would want to steal?
The sword.
I wish the thief had believed it was a replica. A shame and a sin.
They would have needed a ladder.
I don't think so.
The monk stepped to the wall next to the archway and pointed to a spot in the stone that was shiny, as if it had been polished.
There and there and there.
Someone climbed the wall. Impressive.
A shame. And a sin.
Very much a shame.
It's unfortunate that we didn't sell the sword last year.
Someone tried to buy it. Maybe that's who stole it.
It was an older gentleman, a doctor from the south. He offered a good price, and Brother Villon considered it. Perhaps we should have accepted.
This doctor...
I don't recall his name, but he couldn't have climbed the wall.
A doctor.
He was polite and didn't press us.
Anya walked out through the archway and again stood in the drizzle. The monk joined her.
Thank you for taking the time to meet with me, Brother Maynard.
The pleasure was mine, Anya Creed.
The elevator was working, but Anya took the 216 steps back down, not minding the drizzle, and enjoying the solitude, as no one else was using the stairway. Anya had booked a room in the Grand Hotel Beau Site, a Best Western in the lower part of town. On the way to it, in one homey, sandalwood-scented shop, she found a small crocheted throw with the image of the Black Madonna and the main station of the cross. It would make a lovely baby blanket, a memory of Raymond's visit to France. On second thought, she put the throw back on the shelf and decided a U.S. savings bond would make a more welcome gift. She picked out a few postcards and also bought a soft drink and chips, which she devoured under an awning. Then she walked around the lower city until even the tourists who didn't mind the weather disappeared for dinner. After taking a hot bath to chase off the chill and snuggling into a voluminous robe the hotel provided, Anya settled into her room at the Beau Site, seated at her laptop. Anya surfed the internet, searching for info about Roland and Durandal. She started with the theft reports from the cloister here in town. Nothing new since she'd looked yesterday, and nothing that Brother Maynard hadn't revealed, except for attesting to the sword's authenticity. Durandal had been taken after her fight at the train station in Paris, but before the Romany pair had come after her and Raymond under the Avignon Bridge.
Are the incidents related? Is the same gang involved?
Anya didn't believe in coincidences. Avignon, Rocamadour, and Paris. The targeted swords were the common factor. But Brother Maynard hadn't remembered seeing any Romany tourists the day Roland's sword was stolen. On a whim, she checked eBay. There was an assortment of old swords listed for sale, but nothing matching Durandal's description. Definitely old stuff, though. Some of the swords pretty valuable. A few offered proof of authenticity. Anya was familiar with other internet sites that dealt with antiquities whose origins were murky. Some of the relics stolen from the Egyptian Museum in Cairo in recent years were sold this way. A few of the items were recovered in bidding wars, but the thieves were never apprehended. Tonight, nothing caught her eye. Durandal, or anything that looked like it, was not for sale online. The oldest authentic piece was a saber from the Civil War. The hours melted away as Anya lost herself in historical tidbits of the internet's various nooks and crannies. One link led to another and another, tugging her along.
Nothing, nothing, something.
Here was a news report, an entry just posted several minutes ago, about the theft of an old sword from the Wallace Memorial near Stirling, Scotland. It included a picture of the Wallace sword, a massive claymore meant to be wielded two-handed, once owned by the Scottish martyr.
Huh. Durandal, the Wallace sword, and the attempt on my sword.
Collector!
It seemed the Romany youth was telling the truth when she'd pressed him up against the wall in Avignon. The incidents were indeed all related. Someone was collecting historical weapons.
Have there been more thefts?
It was midnight. She'd intended to turn in early so she could return to Paris first thing to find leads there. Instead, she kept at it. Durandal, the Wallace sword. Anya posted questions on some of the chat sites frequented by archaeologists and treasure hunters.
Has anyone heard of ancient weapons gone missing? Stolen? Sold?
She was about ready to give up when she got a nibble from a PhD student in Sendai, Japan. The university there was back in session. He was an American studying for his doctorate in astronomy, but all things Japanese intrigued him, and he'd come across a recent report of a historical katana that had been sold for a ridiculously low price. He referred her to a story covered in the English edition of a local paper. Anya emailed him her thanks and clicked open the link. Honjo Masamune was the name of a sword sold to a French college professor visiting Tokyo last month. She clicked one link after the next, pulling up file after file, settling on one at a Japanese museum's website that seemed to have the most complete account. Anya searched until she found an English translation. Masamune had been a celebrated swordsmith, considered Japan's best weapons maker. He'd fashioned many blades, ones in collections throughout the world worth small fortunes. One sword in particular was famous, the Honjo Masamune, passed down throughout the shogunate period. Records claim that Masamune had lived in the mid-1200s to early 1300s. He'd been trained by masters Saburo Kunimune and Awataguchi Kunitsuna, names that meant nothing to Anya, and was known for making exceptional blades at a time when steel was usually riddled with imperfections. Some of his swords, called tachi in Japanese, were laced with a pearly substance that made them shimmer. They were noted for having gray shadows on the front of the blade and clear lines on the leading edge. Anya's own sword had similar lines and shadows. The Masamune Prize was presented at Japanese sword-making competitions to this day. The Honjo Masamune was considered his greatest creation, possibly the finest sword ever made in all of Japan. It was likely named for General Honjo Shigenaga, who'd acquired it during a battle. Anya dug deeper, finding the history fascinating. Shigenaga had been attacked with the blade, which split his helmet. Though injured, he survived and claimed the sword as a prize. After that, it passed from one hand to the next, sometimes sold, sometimes inherited. It was declared as a national treasure in the 1930s. The last Japanese owner was a Tokugawa Ayamasa, who gave it to the Mejiro police station in December 1945. A month later, that sword and 14 others were given to Coldy Bymore, a sergeant in the U.S. 7th Cavalry. From there, the sword was sold to various foreign collectors, first in the United States, then Europe, returning to Japan, where it was sold again just a month ago. Its owner had lost practically everything in the 2011 tsunami. Japanese museum officials were horrified that it only went for $1 million. It was worth far more, but the museums were in no position to outbid the collector. The name of the buyer, a college professor, was Arshar Gion. The academic world wasn't known for exorbitant salaries, so Anya figured he likely came from money to be able to afford something like this. And he was French. She started searching for information about him and came up with frustratingly little. A professor of religious studies, born in Nice, currently on sabbatical, married once and divorced. The only name listed for his ex-wife was Beatrice. He'd written a doctoral thesis on comparative religions in modern European society and published several related articles. Nothing here indicated he'd have the money to buy an expensive sword, let alone afford a lengthy trip to Japan. No mention of inheritance, no address listed. Anya noted the time, 3:12 a.m. She intended to return to Paris later today and pay a visit to the university to discover more about Arshar Gion. Anya bookmarked a few sites, then set her laptop up to recharge and called it a night. The next morning, Anya's laptop chirped to announce an incoming email. One of her contacts had sent her a notice about an historic sword going up for auction tomorrow, in Spain. Anya immediately booked a flight. The place had been a boutique at one time, one of those pricey little consignment shops filled with designer clothes and painted a mix of pastels. Sarah could make out the original name in bleached green paint. Seconde fois, second time. But over that, in eggshell white, was its new name in block letters. Tome Tranquille. Tranquil Tomes was a bookstore of sorts, three doors down from Les Non-Faits Revue, where Sarah and her latest cohorts had eaten dinner, a restaurant that borrowed the name of one of Monet's most famous paintings. Sarah had hardly touched her wild duckling Rouennaise. She was anxious and didn't want a heavy meal to dull her senses. This was all on her. She'd found Tranquil Tomes after a lot of research. Lawton had been pleased with her find. It was her mission to be in charge of, a real chance to prove herself. And it was smack dab in the middle of Rouen, Dr. Lawton's city of choice. He'd sent two men with her, twins, Luc and Gaëtan Niveau. Of Lawton's associates, they were the closest to Sarah in age. Though black, they had been adopted as infants by a rich white couple north of Paris, friends of Dr. Lawton's. Sarah was glad to have the two with her. Their company was a nice break from Arshar's. If he'd been along, he would have taken charge. This was her mission. The bookstore posted evening hours, and the three of them had gone in shortly after 8. Ugh. It smelled of something she couldn't place, some musky scent that hung heavy in the air, so sweet she almost gagged. Probably an incense stick. There it was, smoldering in the cupped hands of a ceramic Buddha. Sarah hated incense. She noticed Luke wrinkling his nose and was pleased that it wasn't just her. The books, displayed on two walls, were sparse compared to most bookstores. Sarah took the shelves to her right, the brothers the ones to the left, their long raincoats swishing around their calves. She watched them pick up one thin book after another, reading the titles. Luke started to page through one as if he were actually interested. Sarah nodded to the sales clerk at the back and picked up one of the thicker books. She watched the black-haired shopkeeper out of the corner of her eye, trying to decide if it was a man or a woman hunched over the counter staring at an iPad. The clothing could have passed for pajamas. Creating Values was the title of the volume in Sarah's hands.
Derived from Nichiren Choshu, it has recently spread into Europe and the United States.
Sarah's research had revealed that in the past 5 decades, the sect members had been aggressively proselytizing, using a strategy called shakubuku, or break and subdue. Gaetan flapped a thin book in his right hand. He had a small ceramic Buddha in his left, a price tag plastered to its bulbous stomach.
Happiness is the primary goal of life, eh? I can get into happiness, but this place gives me the creeps.
He placed the book on a shelf. Chanting seemed to be coming from the back room behind the shopkeeper.
So, these claim that happiness is gained through goodness, prosperity, and beauty. Well, the guy back at the counter is no beauty. Says, too, that it relies on the teaching of Lotus Sutra. Wonder if that's anything like the Kama Sutra.
They're getting stronger in France, these Buddhists. They're in other places in Europe, but mostly in France, from what I gathered.
So happiness can include material success, like cars, big houses. That guy doesn't look like he's got money, though.
Sarah drew the attention of the shopkeeper, who finally looked up. A man. He had a soul patch growing beneath his lower lip.
Can I help you?
Just looking. You can help me.
Of course.
How many members do you have?
This bookstore?
No, I don't mean branches of this bookstore. You have all these books on Buddhism.
Buddhism is the world's largest religion.
But you're part of a particular kind of Buddhist sect, right? I mean all this material, the books, pamphlets, that poster advertising meetings. One tonight, your...
Members in this city?
All over.
6 million in the world. We are new to Rouen.
I see.
And you are interested in Soka Gakkai? You want to join? Study?
This book...
Luke pointed to one in French with a red cover.
This book mentions a political party. Clean government.
Yes. Formed in the 1960s. Komito. Third largest political party in Japan.
You're from Japan?
My grandparents and my father. My mother is French. I was born here.
So, you belong to a Buddhist branch? Like an offshoot. You hold meetings here.
A branch of Mahayana Buddhism.
And you accept anyone? Color doesn't matter?
Yes. Although we ourselves were not always accepted.
What do you mean by that?
In the 1940s, I was told, my grandparents were arrested as thought criminals. Our branch had fewer than 3,000 families then.
And now you have 6 million?
In the world, yes.
The shopkeeper indicated the beaded curtain behind him.
We meet here on Mondays. You can join us and observe if you're quiet.
And what do you do back there?
We discuss, we study, we evolve. We practice personal fulfillment.
I got one of your pamphlets. That's why we came.
The door opened and a woman came in, tugging a young boy. She went straight to a shelf with incense burners.
Which one should we get Aunt Vicky for her birthday?
Her son didn't answer. He was watching Gaetan and Luke.
You discuss what?
The Lotus Sutra. An important passage stresses that every one of us has a latent Buddha nature. All of us can attain Buddhahood.
The shopkeeper was saying something else, but Sarah had missed part of it, mesmerized by the sound of the chanting.
The divine life state, the true path of enlightenment, we read in the Doctrine of 3,000 Realms in a Single Moment of Life by Ichinen Sanzen that Buddhism is practiced here, in the back room, in the shop, out on the streets of Rouen. It is practiced everywhere in daily life. It is not relegated to some mystical place high on a mountaintop. We overcome all of society's obstacles. We defeat, spiritually and intellectually, those things that would keep us from our divinity.
Sarah replaced the book she was holding and drifted closer, her feet moving in time to the chant. The customer turned back to the little boy who was still watching the twins. She was holding a rosy pink Buddha incense burner with a grin spread wide across its fat face.
I think this one will do nicely for Aunt Vicky, don't you? And I suppose we should get her some incense to use with it.
The shopkeeper looked around the twins to the woman and her boy.
May I recommend the Oroshika varieties? The cones of lemongrass, French lavender, and ylang ylang are especially pleasing.
So global warming would be history if everyone was Buddhist, right?
I suppose you could look at it that way. Here, we teach our members how to apply Buddhism to their daily lives and to promote its spread through society.
That's exactly why we showed up.
To join us?
Luke shook his head. Sarah walked over to the customer.
Lovely little boy.
Michael. His name is Michael, and he just turned 3.
American. Sounds like you're from Boston?
New York, actually. My husband is teaching a semester at the business school in the city. He wants to live here full time. You're American, too?
From Boston.
Visiting? Studying?
Are you a Buddhist? A sect member?
Oh, not exactly, but I come here a lot. I like the way they think.
You would do well to leave now.
Now see here, I'll shop where I want, read what I want, and I'll...
Sarah pulled out the Sig Sauer she'd concealed beneath the flap of her jacket. She pointed it at the woman's forehead.
No!
In one fluid movement, Gaëtan reached into the folds of his long raincoat and pulled out a saber. He raised the blade and sliced through the shopkeeper's throat. Sarah stepped around the wailing boy to the front door, blocked it, and flipped the sign around to read closed.
What about the boy?
He's 3, too young to read.
The people chanting in the back room must have been able to hear the boy, but were too caught up in their chanting to come check.
Let's move.
Leading with the gun, Sarah stepped through the curtain to the back room. Guy Tong was in next and rushed a tall Japanese man who looked to be making a martial arts move. Guy Tong finished him in 2 swipes. Luke joined them a heartbeat later, drawing a saber with his left hand and an antique katana in his right.
May we finish this for you?
Certainly.
Sarah thrust the Sig Sauer back in her waistband and watched the twins appreciatively. The sabers and katana glistened in the light of a few dozen candles. The brothers were fencers who'd competed at the 2008 Olympics in Beijing. Gaëtan had narrowly missed meddling. Now they ran a small fencing school near Dr. Lawton's warehouse. Sarah knew they favored foils, but sabers were more effective for killing.
That didn't take long. In and out in less than half an hour. Hanzo Masamune served me well. Hopefully I will gain my named sword soon.
Hey, me too.
Security camera. Gotta find the feed.
Gaëtan returned to the front room.
Make sure they're all dead, Luke. No one except that little boy gets to keep breathing.
Sarah followed Gaëtan. He was rummaging around under the counter.
Found it.
Can you erase us?
He was fiddling with some of the controls.
Ah, hell. I'm not familiar with this model.
He yanked at the machine and pulled it loose.
Let's just take it with us.
Computer?
It's a primitive operation. Just a calculator, cash box, and ledger. Oh, and the iPad. Looks like he was playing solitaire.
He slipped the ledger and iPad under the same arm as the security system hardware.
Finished, Luke?
Sarah fixed her gaze on the boy. He'd stopped crying. He was sitting next to his mother, patting her hand.
We need to get out of here, guys. We've got more stops to make tonight, and you've got a chartered flight to catch before sunup.
It's a shame you won't be coming with us, Sarah.
I guess Dr. Lawton's got other plans for me. That's okay. But before we do anything else, my stomach's growling, and I've got a hankering for a footlong. There's a sandwich shop the next street over. A cold-cut combo would do nicely.
She grabbed the cash box on the way out. Anya passed the taxi stand and got on the public bus after landing at the airport in Burgos. The Spanish city was colorful, and she took it in as she watched people get on and off at the stops. Belorado, Segovia, Avenida de Castilla y León, San Roque. She stepped off at Glorieta de Logroño, as it was the closest to the hotel she'd booked. Anya had never been to Burgos before, but she'd done her research. It was less than 200,000 residents and was a principal city in the northern part of the country. If she could manage it, she hoped to take in the Cathedral of Burgos, Cartuja de Miraflores, and Huelgas Reales Monastery while she was here. And she intended to visit the new Museum of Human Evolution, expected to become one of the most visited museums in the country. She might as well see something more than the inside of an auction house. Anya left her suitcase at the hotel and took off shopping. She needed something appropriate for tonight's event, and nothing she'd brought to France for her shoot would do. After the fight at the train station in Paris, her cocktail dress needed some repairs. This vacation was getting expensive. Anya started with a pair of bronze leather shoes, 4-inch heels, designed by Sergio Zelcher, costing the equivalent of $200. The dress, one of Cristobal Balenciaga's designs, was 4 times that amount, on sale. It was a soft print of buttery shades with dark brown accents. Anya didn't need to be extravagant, but others at the auction would be wealthy, and she had the role of a well-to-do American television personality to play. Gaëtan parked in front of a narrow 3-story house on Rue Lefort Gonsolin and turned off the lights, but he left the motor running. Sarah opened the glove compartment and took out a small flashlight, flicked it on, and held up a piece of paper.
This is it. Last stop. Listen, Gaëtan, Luke and I will take this, but keep a close eye out, okay?
What?
Keep an eye out. You know, watch the neighbors. If it gets a little loud, we don't need anyone coming over or calling the police.
I will keep both of my eyes out.
Luke got out of the back seat and drew his katana, leaving the saber behind.
Just honk if there is a problem. We will be quick. We're due at the airport in an hour.
Sarah didn't expect trouble. It was after 11, and while there were a few lights on here and there down the block, more than half the houses, including this one, were dark. People probably had to get up early for work in the morning. Sarah crept toward the house, crouching like a secret agent from a B-movie. Luke followed a few yards behind, checking left and right, then waited while she went around to the back. After a few moments, he slipped to the side door and put his ear to it. Sarah came back.
No electronic security on the outside anyway.
Take a look up there.
An open window?
And the room looks dark. Maybe he isn't home.
Car's in the garage. Boost me.
Luke set the sword on the ground and laced his fingers together. Sarah stepped into his cupped hands and he raised her so she could grab onto a decorative piece of brickwork. All that wall climbing at the gym had served her well. She scrabbled up and slid through the window, poking her head out and giving Luke a thumbs up. Several minutes later, a light came on toward the back of the house, and Sarah opened the side door.
Easier than I expected. I'm getting good at this.
She motioned him inside and closed the door behind him.
He had a security panel in the front hall, but the idiot didn't bother to turn it on.
Sarah had stuck her gun in the waistband of her pants, but pulled it out and waved it at the home's occupant, now tied to a kitchen chair.
Make sure he can't get loose.
Luke tightened the knots.
Where did the rope come from?
Pull cords from a drape upstairs. So I did good, huh?
I'm impressed, Sarah.
Luke stepped back so he was shoulder to shoulder with her, studying the captive. The man in the chair looked terrified, with sweat beating on his forehead and his lips working around the wad of paper towels Sarah had stuffed in his mouth.
He was real cooperative when I showed him the gun. Luke, meet François Loubet. He manages one of the smaller banks in Rouen, 5th on our list, last target tonight. He thinks we're here to rob him. Idiot.
We will rob him, Sarah.
Eventually. If I take the gag out and you talk above a whisper, it'll be the last sound you ever make. Got it?
Mm-hmm.
She waited another moment and took the gag out.
What do you want? Money? I have money upstairs. More. I can get you more. From my bank. I can...
We don't want money.
Jewelry? You said you were going to rob me. Gold. I have a gold ring with diamonds on the bureau in the bedroom.
We don't want jewelry.
And what?
What do we want? We want to save your soul. But I don't think that's going to happen. I saw a cross hanging upstairs. Another one here.
Sarah nodded to the wall, and Luke followed her gaze. It looked almost like a Christian cross, but with 4 more points coming out in a starburst pattern from the center.
Scientology crosses. The other targets didn't have them displayed quite so prominently. 8 points represent their so-called 8 dynamics of existence. Scientology, what an absolute mindless idiot.
I don't understand.
What's not to understand? You're a Scientologist, Francois. You follow a religion made up by a science fiction writer. L. Ron Hubbard probably meant it as some joke, and you and a couple 100,000 others bought into it. I've read all about you. If old Elrond found his way to heaven, I bet he's laughing his ass off at the lot of you.
Please.
We'll see if the handful of other known Scientologists that I killed tonight are being reborn.
Sarah stuffed the paper towels back into Francois's mouth. He struggled in the chair, threatening to tip it over. Luke raised his katana.
Like I said, we'd give you the chance to repent, but I'm doing you a big favor. You're an alien, right? One who'll get reborn, your literature claims. If you think about it, you should be grateful. We're giving you a chance to start over.
She put the gun to the side of his head.
No need to make this one look like a robbery.
This is the sixth Scientologist we got tonight. Police will figure out the connection. Hey! They might think there's a serial killer on the loose targeting Scientologists.
The Buddhists?
Well, yes, them too. Serial killer bait. Buddhists and Scientologists. And that's just the tip of the religious iceberg. Dr. Lawton said the cops would go ballistic.
We are not serial killers.
No, we're crusaders.
Paladins.
Yes, paladins. And tonight... Tonight, Luke, the cleansing has begun.
Well done, Sarah.
Well done, Sarah.
You did fine.